Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour we'll recap Governor J.B. Pritzker's budget address and get some reaction to it. We'll also discuss electric vehicles. The industry has been making strides, but the Trump administration could slow things down. There is a push to add more access to college classes for those in Illinois prisons. Legislation has been introduced to ban what is known as school-based ticketing, where students can face fines for in-school behavior. The parents of a college student who died after a night of drinking say they hope something good comes from that incident. And a major restoration and conservation effort in the Great Lakes could be at risk. Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, this week, Governor J.B. Pritzker proposed growing state spending by $2 billion without new income or service taxes. But the administration acknowledges uncertainty in the fiscal landscape due to the rapid pace of policy changes by the Trump administration. Spending and revenues would each grow about 3% under his plan. The governor proposed increasing education spending by $350 million and cutting a $330 million health care program serving non-citizens ages 42 to 64. The annual budget address is the first step in a months-long negotiating process with the General Assembly. Illinois Republican lawmakers are blasting the governor's budget proposal. House Minority Leader Tony McCombie calls the budget poor policy.
Illinois families deserve an honest and transparent government, and increases of spending by $2 billion and masking a $3.2 billion deficit on paper, setting taxpayers up for a potential tax hike on May 31st.
While Pritzker's plan doesn't call for tax hikes now, the state may have to find revenue for a deficit of $1.7 billion. In a statement, Senate Minority Leader John Curran says he's disappointed the governor's not controlling government spending. And Pritzker used his annual address to call out President Trump. Dave McKinney has that story.
A possible 2028 presidential contender, Pritzker named Trump a half dozen times in his budget speech. On Trump's tariffs, Pritzker predicted tomatoes, beef, and beer would soon cost more for Illinoisans. On Trump's cost-cutting frenzy, Pritzker said it imperils health care for hundreds of thousands of Illinoisans, Meals on Wheels for senior citizens and the disabled, and the state's vital agricultural industry. The governor accused Trump of imperialistic behavior and vowed not to let him, quote, steal Illinois tax dollars.
My oath is to the Constitution of our state and of our country. We don't have kings in America, and I don't intend to bend the knee to one.
The governor's attacks drew Democratic cheers and GOP catcalls.
Electric cars and trucks have started to catch on in the U.S., but the Trump administration is no big fan. The president is putting the brakes on more EV charging stations. What does that mean for the industry and for people considering a purchase? Sasha Ann Simon spoke with Karen Weigert, director of Loyola University Chicago's Baumhart Center for Social Enterprise and Responsibility, and Danny Robles, the legislative relations director for the Illinois Environmental Council.
Karen, I'll start with you. When people talk about wanting electric vehicles, one of the biggest concerns, besides the price, is where to charge it, especially on long-distance trips, right? It's definitely come to mind for me. I'm not an EV driver, but that's the thing holding me back. I'm like, but are there enough, when I want to do my cross-country road trips? So how big of a deal is it that now President Trump is putting the brakes on things? He's halting funding for more charging stations.
Yeah, absolutely. It's without a doubt a challenge, but it's not the only part of the picture.
Yeah.
And so when you think about your example of you want to know how you're going to take your longer trip, publicly funded infrastructure is one of the ways you would find a charging station. There's also privately funded infrastructure that is publicly available. In fact, many of the auto companies have banded together and have their own plan to build infrastructure, to build charging that'll be across the country. And that's companies like General Motors, Toyota. They've actually created their own group. So There will be more charging infrastructure. But certainly, as you're thinking about making that choice, you mentioned price. That's a factor. You mentioned, where do you charge? That can absolutely be a barrier. And so this can have a bit of a chilling effect, but it's not the only way you'll be able to find charging.
Yeah, to that end, Danny, I mean, there are currently just over 4,000 active public charging ports here in our state. I think I know the answer here, but that's not enough, is it?
No.
you know, we definitely need a lot more to just meet the demand of people. And, you know, I think the news that we're hearing of President Trump repealing, you know, the national electric vehicle infrastructure money or the charging fueling infrastructure money, you know, the state was really needing a lot of that funds to make sure that we had charging infrastructure, especially in places down state where, you know, we might not have as much availability on the highways. And, you know, part of the money that was directed from these grants were meant for low-income communities. So 50% of the charging fueling infrastructure funding was meant for those low-income communities mm-hmm. to make sure that, you know, we are building equity to the future of electrification.
Yeah, tell us more about things happening on the state level, because Governor Pritzker has pledged state resources to fund the expansion of charging stations. I know we had last year we heard of a number that, you know, he wanted to hit by the end of the year. Fill us in on what's happening right now state level to promote the expansion.
Yeah, I mean, Governor Pritzker, you know, he definitely has the goal of 1 million EVs by 2030. And, you know, we're looking at what we can do here at the state level. You know, although we did take a pretty heavy hit with the federal funding, you know, we that have a lot of movement here. So, for example, during the Climate and Equal Jobs Act, the state directed our public utilities to build up beneficial electrification plans. And, you know, we're seeing some of those pieces also come to light with some of their own incentives. So, you know, I think last week, ComEd announced that they had a funding incentive of about $100 million for public and private infrastructure for charging networks. So, you know, the energy is still here in the state. We're definitely still looking to move towards electrification, just knowing that it's heavily needed to make sure that we are curbing our carbon emissions in the transportation sector.
And Danny, transitioning cars and trucks to electric, it's a big part of our state also reaching the climate goals that were set out in CEJA, or the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act. Just give us the specifics there.
Yeah. So the Climate and Equal Jobs Act, you know, the big goal is reducing our energy consumption of coal and transitioning it to 100% renewable by 2050 mm-hmm. And building out a lot of jobs in the process, right?
And there are health impacts too, right?
Yeah, huge health impacts. So knowing that, you know, coal, fossil fuel, and all those sources of energy produce a lot of pollutants is a huge concern for a lot of communities. So especially with heavy-duty trucks and medium-duty trucks, we know that those tend to have pollutants like nitrogen oxides and particulate matter that affect people's cardiovascular and pulmonary health. So, and knowing that a lot of the major arteries for those heavy-duty vehicles are in communities of color, that those are big risks that we're seeing, and one of the reasons why you know, we put a lot of energy to
that focus on low-income communities that you mentioned earlier too. Yeah, and so Karen, make this make sense. How does what's happening then at the federal level affect the equitable transition to electric? And when we're talking about equitable here, give us some context.
Sure. I think as we started this conversation talking about the infrastructure story about charging, and one of the things that was in this piece, the specific piece, it's NEVI. It's the National Electrification the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure. And the goal is to fill gaps. And so that's really why there's a serious equity question, is places where the economics work to have charging, you have charging. So there is infrastructure. The fact that we have hundreds of thousands of electric vehicles on the road and nationally, you know, over 112,000, I think, just in northern Illinois. So majority of this of Illinois' electric vehicles are here. There's more charging infrastructure. And so the real gap here is that how do you fill it in a rural area where there might not be the economics that support charging?
Right.
And so this is the challenge, is there are places in every state that don't have access to infrastructure the way other areas might. And so this is the funding that would have helped address that. And so every state had the opportunity to create a plan to see how they could fill in these gaps so that there really would be equity in the infrastructure that then is there as people start to see more price parity and more incentives or more rebates to actually mm-hmm. buy the electric vehicle.
And while all this cutting and freezing is going on, yesterday we caught up with Jennifer Morand, who's the GM of the Chicago Auto Show. And here's what she had to say about the demand of EVs.
It's estimated that 20 new EVs are going to come to market just this year. We're seeing a huge uptick in adoption of EVs. It's not maybe as fast as the previous administration was hoping for, and this new administration, as you know, has kind of pulled back a little bit. You know, the mandates aren't there as aggressive as the previous administration. But that said, we are still seeing adoption, and it's estimated that one out of four vehicles purchased in this next year, 2025, will be electrified.
So, Karen, sales of all electric and hybrid vehicles reached 20% of all new car and truck sales in the U.S. last year, which happened for the first time, but the numbers weren't quite as high as what was expected. What do you make of that?
Yeah, the growth the year before was huge.
Yeah.
And the growth is still there. So the numbers are still going up. They didn't go up quite as fast as they had previously. And there are lots of things that can jump into that. One is that the early adopters bought their vehicles. You know, so that's really one of the questions. When are people buying and who's really interested and did they already have that chance? And then there are, you know, broader questions about, you know, the vehicles that are available. Are people seeing the one? Now that there's so much supply, people are waiting for the vehicle that they might want. Mm-hmm. And that's a benefit of the story that we have here, which is that you now have every major automaker producing electric vehicles. But we'll also have to see, you know, what are those carrots and sticks as we look forward? The word mandate has been used a lot. There really was never a mandate, but President Biden certainly had a goal of 50% of all vehicles being electric by 2030. That goal is now gone at the federal level. And so what we're going to have to watch are what are the different policies and programs that could support a growth phase or a slower growth phase. And we're in the middle of trying to see where all these directions are going to take us.
Well, Danny, Jennifer Moran said that car manufacturers are interested in having electric options for individual consumers. This isn't quite the same for electric trucks or buses, is it?
No, for electric buses, we are, you know, those heavy duty vehicles. We know that
there are challenges, right, to transitioning to electric fleets.
100%. A lot of that is knowing the range of the vehicle needs. We know that, you know, for some of the fleets that, you know, operate within a city range, those are easier to transition. So thinking about your school bus fleets, your public transit fleets, delivery vans, those are a little easier. And we have seen an increase in those sales. But the heavy duty ones like your cross country trucks, those are a lot harder to electrify. And we're looking at different options to help reduce carbon emissions from those sorts of vehicles. But, you know, I think the goal here is that we don't want a mandate to just fully transition. We want to give the consumers options, whether those are public or private consumers.
Yeah.
We want to make sure that they have the option to make what makes most sense for their business.
Friday, Karen, Illinois announced a new round of incentives. So Illinoisans can get $4,000 for buying an EV. Of course, the idea here is to encourage more folks to go ahead, you know, just do what the so-called early adopters did and just go ahead and just outright purchase an electric vehicle. But we know Trump has said that he would try to end these rebates, as we discussed. How long would that take? And I should probably ask you the same thing I've been asking folks as we've been unpacking Trump's policies here. Can he do that?
I appreciate the last question, because as we look at the financial support for electric vehicles, you have to look at the underlying funding for each piece. And here in Illinois, there's the legislation that Danny referenced earlier, the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act. And so there is funding from the state, essentially from all ratepayers or really taxpayers here in the state, that can support these specific incentives. So the state can offer incentives that can be different from what the federal government offers. And there's a clear line. The president doesn't really have the ability to come in and change what the state has decided.
Okay.
And so these $4,000 that are available for electric vehicles, those are funded by the state. It also includes, by the way, $1,500 for a motorcycle.
You
know, so those funds are available. They are available in Illinois. And there's a whole different story about the federal tax incentives and what might happen there.
I see. So, Danny, there are reports from the climate news outlet Heatmap that some early birds who already filed their taxes and they were expecting to get a rebate for buying an EV, they haven't received it because the dealership didn't fill out the necessary paperwork. Can you quickly clarify what's going on there?
Yes. So over the last couple of years, the way that people were able to get their tax incentives has switched. Back in 2023, the dealers had the option to submit the paperwork at the end of the year. So by January 15 of 2024, there was a switch in the last year where the dealers now have to submit it within 3 days of purchase. So it's eligible for that tax incentive. There's been a bit of concern throughout the country that a lot of the dealers weren't educated on this switch, and they have actually harmed a lot of people who, yikes, you know, bought their vehicles with the intention that they were going to get this tax incentive. And, you know, I think some of the concerns that we're seeing right now is it's the U.S. Treasury that's going to have to resolve this issue. And, you know, the U.S. Treasury is now under new administration, and we're concerned that they're not going to be able to move that. So, you know, if anyone bought a EV last year, I would double check with your dealer to make sure that, you know, they had documented that into the database. Otherwise, we might not see those.
Out of luck. Yeah. Okay, leave us with this, Karen. We know California's got some of the strictest fuel efficiency standards in the country, exceeding the federal standard. The state's economy is also the fifth largest in the world, which poses quite an incentive for automakers to continue making cars to try and meet those standards. So do you anticipate that continuing, or are there ways that Trump could roll that back in favor of gas cars?
The ability of California to set its own rules is something that this new administration is definitely looking at. And so we're going to have to watch this one. And California, as you mentioned, it's a huge market for automakers. The standards that California sets, not only are they a market in and of itself, so that attracts automakers to reach them, They also set rules that other states copy almost exactly. And so where California goes, you'll have, you know, a dozen and a half states also follow. So this is one to watch. It's an example of us seeing how far the president's new goals will go, and whether or not he can actually change what this state has done. And they've typically been a leader in setting those standards that lead to climate implications, job implications, but fundamentally lead to choices on vehicles for their consumers.
Well, give me a yes or no on this. Do you think Trump's overall environmental policies will set the electric car industry back? Yes or no, Danny?
Yes, but slightly. I think it's still moving forward.
Karen?
I'm going with it's going to slow it. You have investments in factories last for decades, so this administration lasts for 4 years.
That's Karen Weigert, director of Loyola University Chicago's Baumhertz Center for Social Enterprise and Responsibility, and Danny Robles, legislative relations director for the Illinois Environmental Council. They spoke about electric vehicles and what to look for during the Trump administration. They spoke with Sasha Ann Simons. We've still got more to come here on Statewide. We'll be right back. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Higher education is one of the most effective ways to prevent people in prison from returning. Yet just 7 out of Illinois' 26 prisons provide access to college classes. Legislation to restore state financial aid for incarcerated students could change that and prove especially crucial if federal funding is pulled. Lisa Curry and Phillip has more.
Jose Vidori was serving more than 20 years when he got serious about his education. He got his GED while locked up.
It was the first time I remember my mother ever being proud of me.
Then became the first person in his family to go to college.
When I was told, you have an opportunity to attend a university while I'm sitting in prison, to me, that was a big form of acknowledging my humanity.
Vidori was released from prison 4 months ago. He says he gets why people fall into old patterns and end up back in prison. He's had a hard time finding a job and supporting himself. But he says the education he started in prison changed him. And now going back simply isn't an option.
We shouldn't look at it as just, oh, you're in prison, you can get a piece of paper and a degree. No, these things change people's lives. It changes the way they look at themselves. It changes the decisions that they make. And these are the same people who are going to come back into these communities.
There's a whole body of research showing that higher education in prison significantly reduces a person's chance of being arrested again after they're released. But getting access here in Illinois is hard. Out of nearly 30,000 inmates throughout the state, only about 600 are enrolled in college classes. Jessica Neptune is with the Bard Prison Initiative, a prison education advocacy group. She says prison ed programs in Illinois have to rely on private and, in recent years, federal funding, and it's not enough.
When I'm talking to college university administrators, trying to help professors talk the administrators into the idea of bringing their degree into the prison, money is the bottom line.
Faculty salaries have to be paid, travel to and from the prisons covered. That's where a bill currently under consideration by state lawmakers comes in. If it's passed, people locked up in Illinois will be able to get the same state financial aid for college as students on the outside, like the MAP grant for low-income families. And that funding, Neptune says, would help more Illinois colleges bring their classes to prisons.
We cannot talk as many universities as we need into doing this work to serve the various prisons all across the state without them knowing they have a ballast of public money that they can then blend with private money and do this with real integrity that students who are inside deserve.
Neptune's group estimates that restoring MAP grants for incarcerated students would take up just 0.01% of the program's budget. Compare that to the millions that could be saved if higher education helps keep people from getting locked up again. Dalrice Adams, who leads the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority, says she's heard from skeptics who ask,
why would we put so much into this population? Like, there are so many other folks, you know, that are in poverty that really need the support.
But Adams says it's not one or the other.
These are members of our communities who are coming home, whether we like it or not. And to give them that level of hope, but also restoration.
It's the humane thing to do, she says. She says lawmakers on both sides of the aisle recognize all the good prison education can bring by creating a more educated workforce in the state and reducing the money taxpayers spend on reincarceration. Jose Vidori, the guy with the proud mom, says it was on the inside, in class after class, that he came to see himself as a person and not an inmate.
If it changed it for me, how many other people can it change it for? And that's how the system, that's how legislators, that's how IDOC, that's how everybody else needs to change that old culture of being punitive and look at it from a humanistic point of view.
He's now finishing the bachelor's degree he started in prison. Lisa Corian Phillip, WBEZ News.
Illinois lawmakers just introduced legislation to ban school-based ticketing. It's where students receive fines for city ordinance violations for in-school behavior. Peter Medlin reports.
In the fall of 2019, when Amara Harris was a junior at Naperville North High School, she was accused of stealing a classmate's AirPods. She says she was looking for hers and grabbed the wrong pair by accident before realizing the mistake and returning them to the dean. Still, Harris was ticketed by school police, which included a fine of up to $500. Harris and her mother, Marla Baker, decided to fight the ticket. It took years, but in 2023, a jury found her innocent.
The 4.5-year process was very, very hard on us emotionally, physically, mentally, financially. Just to be holding your breath for 4.5 years, not knowing how her future would look.
Her mom says Amara's had trouble opening up and trusting people since then. She'd never been in trouble before. She was worried if having a ticket on her record would hurt her ability to get scholarships or her license to become a veterinarian.
As a mom, there's nothing I could do to give those 4.5 years back to her. There's nothing. She's not the same. She's changed.
They also filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against the city of Naperville. And Harris's school district isn't the only one where students are ticketed. Last year, two organizations filed a federal civil rights complaint against Rockford Public Schools, alleging discriminatory discipline practices, including their use of school-based ticketing. Over the past two full school years, school police wrote Rockford students more than 250 city ordinance violation tickets for in-school behavior. That adds up to $58,329 worth of fines. Nicholas Meyer is the city of Rockford's former legal director. He oversaw those code violation hearings.
Small fine can be an effective tool to deter behavior. I do believe that.
At districts like RPS, students caught with marijuana don't just get a detention or suspension from their school, they also receive a ticket. Most of the citations were for possession of less than 30 grams of cannabis, but others were for trespassing, and some students who got in fights received breach of peace tickets. The tickets usually cost around $150, but can be as high as $750. To contest it, they have to show up at a code meeting at City Hall on a Wednesday during the school day. Families generally have have 30 days to pay the fine, and if they don't, Meyer says they don't hound families for the money. But those fees can skyrocket if they're sent to a collections agency. Documents obtained by WNIJ say that many of the tickets were sent to collections, but Meyer says that they never were.
No cases were ever sent to collections. That would have gone through our finance department. We have no record of that. Yeah, it was just a sort of a quirk in the system, but we have not and will not be sending cases to collections.
He says that nearly $60,000 is more than he expected, but that not every ticket gets paid since they don't send families to collections. Only two tickets have been issued to students this school year, both of which are still pending, and the city's legal department says they're working on an agreement with the school district to stop school-based ticketing. And RPS says there are certain offenses, like drug possession, that they're legally mandated to notify the police about. It's not the schools writing the ticket, it's the police, even if those police officers are contracted with the district. Amy Galvin is with the education advocacy group Stand for Children, and she says even if that's true, there are plenty of communities where students aren't ticketed.
In our research and our outreach, we have found that those schools are functioning perfectly well.
State Representative LaShawn Ford just introduced a bill to stop school-based ticketing. His bill changes the Illinois school code to ban school personnel, including school police, from issuing tickets for municipal code violations.
Catch young people with like a vape pen. I don't know if police need to be involved in that. I mean, you could simply take it.
Galvin with Stand for Children says schools have better options to correct misbehavior and that ticketing just punishes families. Back in Naperville, Amara's mom's advocacy now extends far beyond just her daughter. Marla has been meeting with school administrators around the state to try to end school-based ticketing in Illinois. She says that no family should have to go through the stress that hers did, and that she hopes Representative Ford's legislation can make sure of it. I'm Peter Medlin.
The five Great Lakes represent the largest freshwater ecosystem in the world. They're also a source of drinking water for about 10% of the country's population. But one of the largest restoration efforts that supports conservation efforts across the Great Lakes and the eight states they border may be at risk. That comes as the Trump administration looks to cut climate and environmental justice programs. With more on this, Claire Lane spoke with the WBEZ climate reporter Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco.
So the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funds all kinds of conservation programs throughout the Great Lakes. Can you tell us just a bit about what kinds of projects they support?
Yeah, sure thing. So even just like an hour north of Chicago in Waukegan, Gleary funds have been used to clean a harbor out of that had something like 82,000 cubic yards of toxic sediment. Even further north in Milwaukee, a similar project removed something like 300,000 cubic yards of toxic sediment. In northwest Indiana, just around the corner, it's helped her plant something like 1,000 acres of native plants. And besides that, like thinking about species and animals, it's helped fund surveys for endangered species like turtles, slugs, and bats. That's just a couple projects. Over the past 14 years, it's funded more than 8,000 projects across the Great Lakes region. So it's massive.
So because it spans so many states, it's popular with both Democrats and Republicans, yes?
Famously, yes, Claire. So this goes all the way back to a 2004 Bush-era executive order to get states and agencies to work together on lake restoration. So not long after that, Gleary was signed into law under Obama in 2010. But since then, it's been incredibly popular across the aisle. As recently as last year, Vice President Vance, then an Ohio senator, voted to extend and increase funding for Gleary. So what we can say is that on at least the Great Lakes, both parties agree that the federal government has a role in funding the protection of this vast ecosystem.
Your reporting also suggests that there's some concern that some of the funding might be at risk. What have you learned so far?
Yeah, so to take it back just a little bit, during President Trump's first administration, he tried several times to cut Gleary funding. It failed, and that's due in part to that bipartisan support, right? This time around, he's successfully impounded funds already congressionally appropriated for things particularly like environmental justice and climate change mitigation. Add on top of that, staffing cuts at the EPA, including our regional office, that's the one that covers the Midwest and the Great Lakes, and that leads Gleary, importantly. So the big elephant in the room is that there's a big chunk of money in Gleary that's supposed to fund climate and environmental justice. So a lot of this is still up in the air.
So did you ask the vice president's office if he still supported the program?
We tried. You know, we emailed, sent direct messages to staff on X, phone calls. It didn't work. No luck. So we don't know where he stands today. Whether or not he agrees with his position from even just a year ago, we just don't know.
So where does the initiative stand right now?
So last month, the reauthorization bill was introduced into the U.S. House, and a similar bill was reintroduced into the U.S. Senate. So we'll see. But we'll be keeping an eye.
Of course. As always, I've been speaking with WBEZ's climate reporter, Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco. Thank you so much for joining me.
Sure thing, Claire. Anytime.
A judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration's effort to shut down the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. To discuss how closing that agency could affect Illinoisans and what can be done locally, Esther Yunji King sat down with Horacio Mendez. He leads the Woodstock Institute, an organization focused on consumer financial protection.
The Bureau investigates all kinds of complaints, and an analysis by the Center for American Progress showed that by the end of 2023, the agency had looked into more than 160,000 cases from Illinoisans. Tell us what kinds of complaints the Bureau takes on.
A majority of those cases have to do with credit reports here in Illinois. Sometimes when you're looking to get a loan or open up a credit card and you get declined for some reason, or you want to clean up your credit so that way you can qualify for a car loan, a credit card, a mortgage, whatever it is, a small business loan, you take a look at your credit report and realize something weird is there. And the CFPB is there to be able to advocate on consumers' behalf. Or in some cases, if there's actual financial loss associated with that, they'll sue and give you that money back.
Well, the agency was established in response to the subprime mortgages and predatory loans that led to the 2008 financial crisis. Talk a little bit about the consequences of dismantling this bureau, particularly for Illinois and Chicago's lower income communities.
The people that end up benefiting from the enforcement of consumer financial protection are the ones that don't have the ability to hire lawyers and accountants and other people to be able to read through the fine print. One of the things that they've been going after are junk fees, overdraft fees, late fees, payday loans, title loans. And just recently, they've had initiatives to lower the amount that banks could charge for overdraft, put a cap on how much credit card companies could charge in late fees if you're a day late in paying your credit card and suddenly you see a $39 fee. They said, no, you can't do that.
So if the bureau is shut down, then where can consumers turn?
There are a lot of organizations that help consumers, but we've all come to rely on the three-ton gorilla that is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to be the heavy hammer through the creation and the legislation that created the CFPB. A lot of the responsibility for consumer financial protection was taken out of other regulatory agencies and put into the CFPB. So the other regulatory agencies, they can only enforce consumer financial protection laws and fair lending laws at financial institutions that have assets of $10 billion or less. All of the big ones, like the Chases, the Bank of America's, the Wells Fargo's, those are all much larger than the $10 billion, and they really dominate the industry. Consumer financial protection is only enforced by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau at those institutions. So if they're gone, they don't have anybody to be answerable to for fair lending or consumer protection laws.
I mean, that's pretty major since those are the big banks that we all know and use. I know that the Woodstock Institute is involved in some efforts to create a state-level agency. What are some of the proposals that are out there?
Senator Mark Walker from the 27th District came up with Senate Bill 1512 to create a state version of the CFPB. And what that does is that it makes it illegal for any financial service provider to engage in deceptive, unfair, abusive, or predatory practices. But the problem is, so long as it's not preempted by federal rules, it's a good idea and it's better than nothing, but it doesn't replace the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Horacio Mendez of the Woodstock Institute speaking with Esther Yunji King. A new tool will allow visitors at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield to explore Lincoln's life through a digital reality. The app Lincoln Unlocked provides an interactive experience with extra history lessons and guided tours all through your digital device. The executive director, Christina Schutt, says visitor feedback led to the idea of offering tours focused on the impact of women and African Americans in Lincoln's time.
We're a community-centered museum, and so we want to hear from our community about how we can continue to improve the experience and make it better for them. And so absolutely, we intend to continue adding to the app experience and providing more of these deep dives into these untold stories.
The app also acts as an accessibility aid for visitors who are deaf or visually impaired and is free to download. There's more to come on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Governor J.B. Pritzker wants to ban cell phones from classrooms. Anna Savchinka has more on that.
It would require school districts to create policies banning cell phones during class time.
In conversations with educators and parents around this state, there is one thing that they commonly cite as an impediment to learning in the classroom: cell phones. Furthermore, cyberbullying has expanded at alarming rates, and it's time for Illinois to take measures to protect our kids.
Some schools in Chicago already banned cell phones, but a spokesperson said the school system is on board with any efforts to get students to pay more attention during class time.
And the governor made his formal budget pitch to state lawmakers this week. State House reporter Alex Degman joined Claire Lane to talk more about it.
So Governor Pritzker said he only wants to raise taxes if it's absolutely necessary. Are there any tax or fee hikes in this budget plan?
Well, the big tax from the state that most people think about is the income tax, and Pritzker's not pitching an increase there this year. But he does have a roughly $1 billion budget hole to fill. So he's looking at a little more than $450 million through a few things. For example, changing the tax structure at casinos, deferring a sales tax payment to the road fund, and convincing people to pay their delinquent taxes through a new incentive program. And the rest is expected to come through an expected boost in both corporate and personal income taxes. So that's raising on its own. Now, budget analysts reiterate that these are the types of one-time enhancements that are proof that the state has a structural budget problem and it just can't keep up with costs year to year.
So what are some of the governor's spending top priorities?
Well, he likes to focus on some core areas of state spending, like education, for example. He wants to continue evidence-based funding increases. So every year, K-12 education gets a $350 million increase. That's planned again, although advocates say they're going to be pushing for more. Pensions. State pensions have long been underfunded, and there's a problem with a certain subsect of pensions that the Pritzker administration wants to try tackling this year through an additional $78 million. And then there's also health care. A little less than $750 million is going to be spent on the agency that oversees Medicaid spending.
So money in, money out. Any notable cuts that the governor was proposing in his state budget?
You know, during his speech today, he mentioned that this is a really difficult budget year, and he mentioned that there are programs that are important to him that are on the chopping block, like, for example, health care benefits for immigrant adults. This is the Medicaid-style state-funded health insurance coverage plan for people who are 42 to 64 who are in the U.S. without legal status. This year, it's expected to cost a little more than $400 million, and the state just, they can't do it. Pritzker does, however, want to keep the program that was originally put in place that covers seniors without legal status 65 and older, which costs around $132 million.
So I was a bit struck by how Pritzker really took on President Trump and how the governor made such a point to express how much he opposes so much of what the president stands for. And he's been doing this over the last couple of weeks. Today, though, even saying America doesn't have a king and Pritzker doesn't intend to bend the knee. What was your takeaway on that?
So this was pretty pointed. I've not heard a State of the State address that focused so much on the feds. And even though he did that in the realm of understanding the potential consequences. For example, 700,000 Illinoisans could get kicked off Medicaid if cuts to the Affordable Care Act go through. And there could be a lot of supply chain breakdowns in Illinois due to the lack of food inspectors. Now, Republicans in the room didn't like this. They appeared to be booing Pritzker as he listed all these federal cuts, and he responded pretty point blankly. And this wasn't even on script. He said, you know, you can boo all you want until your constituents lose their services.
Oof. So what happens now? Lawmakers still need technically to approve all of this, right?
Right. Lawmakers control spending. The governor just outlines what he wants. So Pritzker's office spent months crunching these numbers and coming up with a plan. And now it's up to him to sell lawmakers on it. Now, all these numbers and priorities, as you might know, they're subject to change based on negotiations that are going to happen over the next few months. And now, remember, Democrats do still have a supermajority in both the House and Senate, but with challenging cuts like the ones I just mentioned, it's, you know, not a sure deal for Pritzker, even with all these Democrats.
That's State House reporter Alex Degman. He spoke with Claire Lane. Alex also spoke with the budget watchdog Ralph Martiri, who's the executive director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, about Governor Pritzker's over $55 billion budget plan.
We talked a couple of days ago about what type of budget the state needs to pass this year. And based on what you saw, did the governor propose something that would lead to something that's balanced?
Well, I think what the governor's trying to put on the table is one where current revenues and current expenditures are equal. That's the definition of balanced. And the good news is there is not much of a deficit carry forward from last year. It's only about $170 million when you're talking about a $51 billion budget. That's not a significant debt carry forward. So that should be absorbable after his expenditures for the proposed expenditures, I should say, for the upcoming fiscal year. He's estimating he'll have about a $200 million surplus, which is just enough to cover those carry forward bills.
Now, we've seen the state awarded with credit upgrades over Governor Pritzker's tenure due in part to budgeting, but what long-term pressures is the state government facing, and is the governor doing enough to address those?
I think, you know, you could objectively say, and it'd be really hard to argue otherwise, that Pritzker has been the best fiscal manager of the state's financial resources that we've seen in office easily in the last 25 years. And even in the last couple of years, when he's suggested that the state increase spending, he's actually been willing to go after some of these corporate tax expenditures or smaller tax increases to make sure there was adequate revenue to support it. So the governor's taken a relatively conservative and frankly responsible approach to dealing with the state's finances. What you could see is relying on these one-time fixes, they do get you through a fiscal year or two. They don't solve any of your long-term problems, and they can put you in this position where you're constantly having to look at these smaller revenue sources or tax breaks and eliminating them as just a way to get through budget year now.
Do you think the governor struck the right balance when he was talking about President Trump and the federal government's role in state finances?
Absolutely. What is going on at the federal level is simply not in the country's best interest in any way, shape, or form. So what's really happening is a scale back of investment in programs that matter to people. For Governor Pritzker to say what's happening at the federal level is going to trickle down in a very negative way and impact the state's finances generally, but individual families' pocketbooks and what's going on in their homes and communities and their local economy specifically is exactly right. It's just knowing the scope of it, Alex, you can't yet, right? But taking some of these programs off the table, vulnerable populations are definitely going to be hurt.
Ralph, your top line message to lawmakers as they start negotiations, what does the final product need to look like on May 31st?
I think Illinois is at the point where, as the governor rightly pointed out, we have a $1.1 trillion economy. It's the fifth largest economy of any state. It is the 18th largest economy in the world. It's a larger economy than like Nigeria and Saudi Arabia and Greece. You may have heard of some of these places. Tweaking our tax code to generate an additional $2.5 to $4.5 billion and re-amortizing our pension debt. Think about that in context of a $1.1 trillion economy. It's not a measurable taking of economic activity. It literally could have no negative long-term economic impact. It is too small to be measured. Re-amortizing the pension debt, that's just smart policy, right? You save yourself billions of dollars of wasted debt service. So you reduce the amount of taxes that you actually have to increase on families, and at the same time, move your fiscal condition where it's sustainable.
That's Ralph Martiri, executive director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, spoke with State House reporter Alex Degman. The University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign makes national rankings as a party school, but sometimes the drinking culture turns dangerous. U of I freshman Akul Dhawan died from hypothermia last year after drinking and became separated from his friends. When Emily Hayes first spoke to his parents, they blamed campus police for failing to find him in time. Now, a year later, Ish and Ritu Dhawan are hoping some good will come from their son's death.
Are there any memories or moments with Akul that you've been cherishing this year?
He went with me to Japan during his senior year spring break in high school. You know, that was sort of my gift to, you know, our gift to him, that, you know, he's pretty much done with his high school. A lot of memories. We are going to Japan this spring break, because it was only myself and I, you know, two of us went, but now we're all going. My wife really wanted to go because she feels like she missed out on that trip, and he really loved Japan. So we're trying to memorialize, trying to, you know, relive his memories. And that's what we've been trying to do.
When we last spoke, you had filed a complaint against the University of Illinois Police Department. The police officer who did not find your son that night when he was reported missing resigned in October. How do you feel about that?
We did not know a lot of those details, and we have been all trying to, you know, look forward, because no matter what we do and what we think, we're not bringing him back. So one of the things our therapist, you know, tells us, you know, how can you channel your grief, your energy into something good that could A, help other kids, and B, you know, we could start something in his memory. And she said that might be a better option. You will feel solace and happiness in that. My challenge is, Emily, to be honest with you, I cannot continue a rational conversation with people, because I break down. And you can see what's happening with me right now.
Yeah. U of I says they're doing more alcohol enforcement during cold weather events now and giving out more information on winter clothing and safety. The school says it's doing more for first year orientation activities on medical amnesty, safe walks in cold weather. Does that sound like the kind of change that you were hoping the university would do?
Really glad to hear that, because I was not aware of any of this. And it's very important. I mean, it's how tragic it is that a young kid can end up in a situation right in the middle of the campus. It's just mind-boggling every night. I just think about it, and I just cannot believe this has happened. And there are, you know, there are some similarities, commonalities, which you think about. And the most important thing is alcohol, which played a huge role in this. So one of the things we are thinking is how can we make parents and students and legislators aware the huge risk alcohols have on kids, especially freshmen. He was so young, absolutely had no awareness. And, you know, it was a young kid, you know, got away from home for the first time, trying to just have fun. So little that we knew, you know, these consequences, these orientations, these trainings are so important. And I look across the board through all universities, right? I mean, there have been so many cases. There is so much room to do, you know, more to help educate, train, and generate awareness of dangers. I mean, hypothermia, he had so many clothes. Everything you can think of. And everything just came back to us in big boxes. I mean, how can that be possible?
Yeah. Thank you so much for talking with me. Is there anything else that you want to say?
No, I just want to thank you, Emily, for reaching out. And I hope that, you know, the message I want to share is the positive message. You know, what can we do to honor our son?
I've been talking with Ish Dawin, parent of Akul, who died a year ago at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. I'm Emily Hayes.
That will do it for Statewide this week. Thanks for being with us. And join us again next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find our episodes where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.